I recently read Doug Madore's blog post, A Year in Internet Analysis 2022, which was a great overview of all the major events on the internet, sort of at a global scale, I guess, for last year. And it naturally reminded me of major internet events in previous years, too, just because of the content he wrote about. And though I found that very interesting all on its own, I did start to notice a theme among all of these events. The ones in Doug's blog post, of course, but also as I think back over years past. The biggest events, the biggest global scale internet disruptions, probably most memorable for me at least that I can think of, seem to be caused by only a few things. Namely, natural disasters, human error, and lately, intentional outages caused by national governments for whatever reason. I really can't remember any major global scale outages that were caused by an SFP going bad or a router CPU being pegged or something like that. Maybe a core switch hardware just failing. Now, from experience as a network engineer, I know those things do happen. But when I think about those huge global scale disruptions, it seems like hardware going down or otherwise good solid code just breaking for no reason, it really doesn't happen that often. At least not often enough and at the scale that affects huge parts of the world, if not the whole world. So today with me I have Doug Madore, the Director of Internet Analysis at Kentik, to talk about his recent blog post, A Year in Internet Analysis in 2022. Let's get started. So, Doug, it's great to have you today. It's been a while since you and I have done something together collaboratively, so it's good to see you. While our audience can't really see you, this is mostly an audio-only podcast, but it is good to see you. And I read your blog post recently, right, A Year in Internet Analysis 2022. And I want to ask you, as we start to get into this, you heard my intro. Do you agree with me that there is this kind of theme among internet outages, not just in 2022, but in previous years, that they all seem to be a result of those kind of three main pillars, natural disasters, undersea cables being disrupted by a hurricane or a volcano or something like in your blog post, human error, you know, configuration problems, people configuring BGP incorrectly, and you mentioned that in your blog post, and then what I really was interested in also toward the end of your blog post, the idea that there are countries that are now intentionally disrupting internet service for the folks in their countries being a cause for a major outage. Do you see that as kind of a main theme, or am I reading too much into it? What are your thoughts?
That sounds like three good categories that covers a lot. I can't think of a counterexample that doesn't fit into one of those, but yeah, I'd agree with that breakdown.
Yeah, I mean, you started off by talking about the eruption near Tonga, and in your blog post, you have that that graphic image. It's so interesting to watch. But that was a volcano exploding, as volcanoes do, right, from time to time, taking out an undersea cable. And therein lies, you know, major disruptions for the nation island of Tonga. And I assume that region. I don't know. I have to look into it more. But why is it that it doesn't seem like devices themselves, like hardware, bad code, really causes a lot of the disruptions? Do you think that's because the internet is that resilient that we're so good at, right, you know, creating hardware, all the major vendors, or is it that we're just not hearing about those because they're not as sexy?
Well, hang on. So I wouldn't go so far to say bad code doesn't lead to outages. In the Tonga example, there was no bad code was not the issue. On that one, you know, in my blog post, I kind of went into. I was years ago in my time at Renesas and then Dyn Research. I had a real interest in trying to identify submarine cable activations, and because they were kind of interesting. And then the Tonga one I had spotted back in like 2013, or I think it was a number of years ago. This was a case where for Pacific Island nations, it's very hard to get them to be connected to the global internet. They're relying on satellite. Satellite's very expensive. per megabit, especially given it's especially bad in the South Pacific because the way that the business of satellite service works is that you kind of get to divide the costs by the customer base. But in the Pacific Ocean, it's a very large piece of real estate that has very few customers, so your denominator is pretty small. So then I remember attending a submarine cable conference or speaking at one in 2013, and someone was talking about the same. You know, at the time, the wholesale bandwidth costs in North America are, I don't know if you even know if these figures, we use these figures anymore, but, you know, it was like a dollar a mega month. You know, like there's always some sort of figure of what's the wholesale a bandwidth cost. It's probably like a penny or something now these days. I don't know. But in the South Pacific, it was on the order of 1,000. So it was like 1,000 times the cost. And you're limited on capacity, high latency, like all these other problems, and you're paying 1,000 times more. So it was an act of humanity to, it was a humanitarian gift to Tonga that the Asian Development Bank and UN put together the money to put this cable to try to modernized society of this country. And then I was following that story, and then you know, part of my interest was there'd be a press release about a submarine cable activation, and then I was just curious to see, we would see it in our internet connectivity data, when did this thing actually start carrying traffic, because those are two different dates. The cable may be ready to go, maybe there's no lie in the press release, it really did happen, but then there's a moment where it's actually carrying traffic. So we spotted that. So I had a little bit of history on Tonga and Petika, because I remember when I saw this, I was like, I remember Tonga, like we talked about this years ago. And then so then they were at that point had turned down all their satellite services. They're completely relying on the submarine cable, and they had to restore, I think, whatever residual satellite antennas were knocked out by the aftermath of the that blast from the undersea volcano.
Yeah, but it wasn't just that undersea cable that caused major issues last year. I mean, you talked about the issue in Egypt, though I don't think that was caused by a natural disaster like a volcano or something. I don't know if there's any volcanoes.
No, I don't know that we got an explanation on that one. I know. Yeah. So I wrote up a blog post on that one as well. And I know Egypt as a choke point in the global internet is a perennial theme, certainly in the submarine cable space of trying to come up with an alternative path. It's a, you know, the Egyptian government makes a lot of money off of that choke point, as they do the Suez Canal. They do it with the internet as well. You pay to cross your cables through that space. But occasionally there are terrestrial outages. They try to build a lot of redundant overland links to connect the cables that go from the Mediterranean to the Red Sea. But every once in a while there's an outage. I remember one a number of years ago I mentioned in the blog post, was we saw one. It looked a little like this one. There was an hours-long outage. And at the time, I had a great contact in Telecom Egypt who managed the submarine or the fiber optics, the overland circuits. And I was like, what happened here? Look, like, I saw an outage. And he's like, oh, my God. He's like, you're not going to believe it. Like, we had people light fire to one of the like COs that trying to get copper out of the lines, not knowing these are all fiber optics, and there wasn't much copper to be had, so they just burned us down, and so they had to at least if it's on land, it's a matter, you know, fixing this stuff usually is in the matter of hours. If it's under the sea, it could be days or weeks depending on where it is.
Right. Well, I mean, I started off by mentioning natural disasters, and we talked about the volcano eruption near Tonga, but we're kind of focused more on undersea cables now. And you did make the comment that there are very few undersea cable connections, specifically in the Pacific. Is that pervasive throughout the world, or is that a very robust method for moving data between continents and among continents? Because I'm wondering, some of those cables also have to be very old, correct?
Yeah. So let's see. There's a couple of things there. One is, you know, if you look at the submarinecablemap.com, I know you've seen
this. The best map of all
time. Yeah, it's a pretty cool thing put out by Telegeography. It's a good reference. I've got one of these printed on my dining room table or dining room wall. Show what kind of nerd I am, but you know, these things follow the same, you know, maritime trade routes that people have been following ships forever. So the highly trafficked paths, you know, between crossing the Atlantic, across the Mediterranean, South Asia, around, you know, the Far East, those lines are, there's lots of cables, there's lots of redundancy. You know, the only risk is that there's ships also going those same paths. They may set an anchor down or drag an anchor and hit a cable. If you were to look at, like, marinetraffic.com, you compare the two, they're going to look very similar of just, like, where are the cables and where are the ships? They're going in the same places. And they're also going to show that they're not – there's no ships or there's very few ships in the South Pacific, and there's very few cables in the South Pacific because it's very – a cable is an expensive endeavor. It is millions of dollars, you know, at least $100 million, you know, onwards to a billion, depending on the length and the complexity. Wow. And the ROI, this is another thing that gets talked about at submarine cable conferences usually, is there's a lot of investors and business people trying to understand the business case around this and how to mitigate the risks and maximize the ROI, because someone has to raise a lot of money, and how much money you're going to make off this, it's not a ton, but you also have this risk if it breaks, you're getting no money and you have to pay to fix it. This is why all the like Google and Amazon and Facebook have gotten into the submarine cable business, because their business is just different. They don't have to make money off the cable. If it serves their greater business, it's good. And so now they're kind of you're driving that industry. But anyway, I'll let you talk, but in the South Pacific, one other interesting thing that happens, it's not that often, but you mentioned some of these cables are old. So as a cable gets old, someone had come up with an idea a while back of, and it's amazing this has actually happened, but so the cables, they'll pull up a cable off the seabed. I can only imagine all the life forms, you know, barnacles things that have attached to this thing as they're pulling this up onto the ship and then relaying it somewhere else. And, you know, in the total cost, I mentioned these figures of either hundreds of millions of dollars, like half of that or more, or no, it's more than half. It's the vast majority of that is the fabrication of the cable, and then there's the installation is the way it's termed in the industry of, like, actually putting it in the water is the installation. The fabrication of cables is the most expensive part. And if you can pull one off the ocean, that's some cost there. So there's been a couple cables that have been relayed as quote unquote donor cables is the term. And so I forget the one that was, a cable may be no longer, this was in the area of Australia, South Pacific. It no longer served its purposes. It didn't have the capacity to handle a major route, but it'd be plenty to hook up a smaller island nation as far as capacity goes. And so you could reuse the cable. And so this has happened a couple of times, which is, again, a pretty mind-blowing thing that this takes place.
Yeah, it is. That's pretty neat. Do you think that the movement toward more ubiquitous satellite connections and connectivity on a global scale is going to solve some of the inherent danger that, you know, undersea cables being dragged up by ship anchors and natural disasters and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I guess it could. It could to some extent. I mean, satellites are never going to have the capacity of a fiber optic cable.
Right.
So that we know is never going to be the case. You know, the other issue I mentioned earlier with Tonga or other countries that are relying on bulk satellite service, latency is an issue. Depending if it's geostationary satellite, then just due to the laws of physics, it takes a certain amount of time for light to travel to outer space and back, and it can't be shorter than a 480 millisecond round trip. It's probably going to be significantly more. O3B came out with the first MEO, medium Earth orbit, and so these are closer satellites. There's more of them, and then it gets more complicated on the ground because you have to now track satellites as they're crossing through the sky.
Because they're not geostationary, correct?
Yeah, this is medium Earth orbit. Geostationary, you can have one dish pointing in one place and then leave it. And so it's real simple.
How far away is geostationary?
You have to look it up. I don't have those numbers.
I'm Googling it as you talk.
Yeah, I'm sure there's some great diagrams. I don't have those figures memorized.
22,236 miles above Earth's equator. So, the laws of physics kind of govern how long it takes light to travel, round trip, out from your location to that satellite.
So you had an O3B create medium Earth orbit, and so that came brought it closer. There's more complexity on the ground equipment. The latency is a lot lower, and in some places where this was getting fielded in places where they were never going to get terrestrial, or it was hard to reach places, then they were getting latencies similar to what you would have with terrestrial. But you know, the latest is these low Earth orbit, this is Starlink, you know, SpaceX, and then OneWeb, and you know, Amazon has a project. They want their they're pretty early on in the Project Kuiper, and there's a bunch of Chinese they call them mega constellations, and these require thousands of satellites. And but yeah, that you know, could that help in a Tonga situation, an undersea volcano takes out Tonga? Yeah, I guess in the case of Tonga, Starlink was one of the first. I think there was other Pacific satellite operators that got in there first, but they were Starlink was providing some of the capacity. They did need to set up a ground station in Fiji because it's only recently that they've had inter-satellite links. So this is their piece to the low Earth orbit, is that if your satellite's very low, then the footprint's very low, and you have to just ricochet up to the satellite and back to the ground, and now you need to have a ground station pretty near close nearby. And so they're this inter-satellite link, being able to go up to a satellite and then from one satellite to another satellite, is like super complex and really hard to do, and they're starting to do it now. So that has to be really solved in order to do things like use low Earth orbit to cross the Atlantic. Right now you can't do that because you can't come back down. You have to go inter-satellite links over, and that's just starting to happen now. So it could. You're just never going to have the capacity.
Right. Not until they invent subspace communication, like in Star Trek, I assume.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's belief that I guess there's some science behind the inter-satellite links, because they're going through a vacuum in space, can actually carry a higher capacity than the link going from the ground to the to the satellite. And so there's some gain to be had in the fidelity of the links and the interspace links.
Yeah, and I have to assume that as that technology progresses and improves, that it will offer a – I mean, I know that it's never going to be the same as like a hard fiber, you know, connection here on the ground. But as it improves in resiliency and in data transfer speed bandwidth, you know, it would be more immune to natural disasters than undersea cables and, you know, things that are affected by hurricanes and earthquakes and things like that. I mean, I can remember when – first learning about all of the this choke point. You mentioned the choke point in the Middle East. There's a choke point, I believe, in the tri-state area of New York. I don't know if it's on the New Jersey side or in Manhattan. And I just have to imagine if there was one problem in that building where all of these connections go through, you know, that's it for the Northeast U.S., which is, you know, kind of a few people. So now I do want to move on to I could talk about undersea cables for the next 3 hours. So we definitely have to do that again.
Me too.
But I do want to get into – you mentioned – you looked at the Rogers outage from last year. That was a big deal. I remember reading a ton of blog posts on that and all of your analysis as well. Really interesting stuff. A terrible, you know, thing to occur, but ultimately – I don't know if we know with full certainty what the true cause of that was, what the root cause, but everything points to human error, correct?
Yeah, so that was, I think, arguably Canada's largest internet outage ever in history. And it was long. I forget the duration, but this is many hours, maybe 24 hours before it was completely getting restored. And yeah, there was some after some root cause published. You know, these things are always to people who are pretty techie like me who are going to read these. It's always insufficient. It's never enough detail. I would love to know some more, and they're never gonna. You're just never gonna get there. But in this case, if you read between the lines, it seemed like what was happening was they had basically leaked the global routing table, which is, you know, over 800,000 routes or something, into their IGP, whether it's internal BGP or something, their internal routing, which is not going to be anything on that scale. And if you're using a protocol like OSPF or something that is very talkative to try to maintain total knowledge of links, these things do not go well together. They're very different styles of routing. So there was basically, they leaked the table in. There's just too many announcements, and these routers were just melting down. Mm-hmm. And you know, why it took so long is I think it seemed like there was some commonalities to the historic Facebook outage the previous fall, where you know there's unforeseen dependencies the engineers were also using Rogers mobile service and the company's using its own communication services to coordinate its work, and when that goes down, they don't have a way to coordinate, and so that extends the outage, because it's very hard to, if you can't talk, if your normal tools for talking are no longer available. But it does reveal some stuff about the Canadian internet. You know, this is an issue where there's different pockets of essentially monopolies and of Rogers and Bell, and this is folks in the internet industry in Canada wrestle with this, and it'd probably be, and they're actually moving towards a more greater consolidation still. If you have your major provider that's got a near monopoly in a region go down, there may not be a lot of great alternatives to use. So that may have contributed to the duration of the outage. Yeah. But yeah, it was a routing thing. Mm-hmm. Sounds like a filter was removed. I guess we're not going to know much more than that. But I would say that, there was a lot of folks, when this outage took place, we're all looking at BGP is a thing that is easy to go to for me and people like me who do internet measurement. And there was lots of routing instability going on at this time. A lot of routes got pulled. But we could see, because we have this, I have the benefit of having our aggregate net flow to look at, of like, what do we see on our customer base? What can we see as far as communications with Rogers? We could see routes that stayed up and the traffic stopped going. And so that means that the route wasn't the problem. The routes were still up and available and at times stable, but they weren't carrying any traffic. And so, you have multiple layers of this onion of their network. You've got some that routers that are announcing their address space to the rest of the internet, and then you got internal routers handling how does the traffic move within the network. Those were down, but they were still advertising their space. So there was some initial claims that they left the global routing table. I mean, some routes did, but that was one thing I tried to pick apart in the blog post, was to say, all right, we can see traffic stopping to routes that are still up. So that it's not really a BGP thing. In that case, it's an internal, not an exterior BGP. Maybe it's an internal BGP, depending on what routing protocol they're using internally. Anyway, so that was.
Yeah, it's interesting that you can, you have this really deep visibility into what's going on in the public internet. And then you can use that and parse it in such a way where you can actually infer what's going on in somebody's private network.
To some extent, yeah.
Yeah. And I remember just a few years ago, prior to Rogers and prior to the Facebook outage, or was it prior? Didn't Facebook do something in Southeast Asia where they accidentally were a transit network for the public internet for a time or something like that?
I'll see.
It was like a major disruption as a result. I don't know if it was Facebook or somebody else, but I do remember.
A couple of things like this. There was a Google incident where they Google leaked had a BGP leak that took down a lot of connectivity in Japan for a while. And I wrote something up on that at the time. They got called.
There's a ripple effect. There's a cascade effect when you get into routing and talking about. Yeah, especially if you're talking about full feeds and things like that, and then redistribution of routes and how you filter, like you mentioned. I mean, it's a cascade effect all the way down to endpoints sitting on your network. You really need to be very aware and careful as a human being engineering, actively engineering and touching, wiggling wires on your network. I remember the AWS outage as well. Remember that? Was it the S3 outage? And it came out that it was somebody who misconfigured something. I don't remember what. I wrote a blog post about that, and my blog post was called Amazon S3 or something like that. We've all been there, because I've been there. Now, I don't work at the global – I didn't work as a network engineer at the global scale, except for some consultant work I worked for – I did for GE. But other than that, it was large enterprise. But, yeah, if you configure something incorrectly, just one little error in an access list or in a route map or whatever it happens to be, or the one I like to joke about is on, you know, maybe it's a major trunk port going in your backbone for layer two and you forget the add command if you're using Cisco devices. And then, boom, everything's down. It's very high impact, and it's just you as a human being that can cause all of that disruption. And I wonder if there is a way – I mean, now that we talk about network automation and programmability and this desire to eliminate that which is error-prone in manual configuration, of course, make things more efficient and cleaner and all that, but also eliminating that error-prone component of manual configuration. I wonder if that is realistic or not. I mean, ultimately, the code that we write in Python, and I think some people still use Ansible playbooks and things like that, is still written by human beings that require an understanding of how BGP works and how to write an inventory list or how to write a route map. It still requires a human being to know that and to figure that out and to parse that in such a way in code where it interacts with everything else going on in the network. So I don't know. I don't know if we can ever get away from the human error component of these types of outages.
It's a lesson in humility.
A lesson in humility, for sure.
I think probably 2021. This will be with us forever, probably. But I think 2021 was definitely the year of learning of humbling experiences of the greats of the internet falling to their knees. You had Facebook. You also had Amazon. Had a couple outages. The second one wasn't as big, but the first one you mentioned, where there was an internal DNS issue, it turned out that a lot of internal services did not use multi-region, which is kind of funny. I mean, that's a cloud operator. They can, it's their stuff. They could be replicating this in every region. Everything was based like the rest of the world in US East one. They were too, and singly homed with their internal services, including their internal DNS. It's kind of, it's easy for us on the outside to be like, you should have known, I think these things, especially the scale that we're talking of, like a Facebook, AWS, earlier in the year, it was Fastly and Akamai had outages in that year. I think every major content provider, has had one of these, and, it is hard to anticipate every dependency. It's out of band. It's easy for us to say, you should have had an out of band communication that doesn't have any dependency on your network and allows you to remote into your stuff and can configure it. And like, that's actually a hard thing to, number one, make, and then two, secure. Can you imagine you're creating back doors that have no reliance on anything, like trying to secure that? I mean, it is harder. It's easier said than done building these things. But
I've been there too. I mean, I've made those mistakes and have had those humbling experiences, but never at a global scale. You know, I've taken down networks. I remember taking down subnets and then entire networks from time to time. But you know, a few enough where I learned from my mistakes and then really took the time to analyze and to investigate and to research prior to making a change. And even then, you know, during that change window, you're sweating, literally sweating, because you're like, okay, here we go. And the whole team is like, you know, on pins and needles. All right, hit the enter button or the enter key. And but it was never at this kind of global scale. And, you know, we've been talking about, what, 8 companies, 10 companies? That's all you've mentioned. The names of literally less than a dozen companies thus far in our conversation. And that, granted, that's just in the scope of our conversation. But the point I'm trying to make is this idea of a very few number of companies holding the, not the power, but all of the connectivity and the data transfer and all of the content even for so much of the global internet today, maybe that's part of the problem, where somebody makes some human being makes one problem at Facebook, and then boom, you have a huge, huge disruption. Whereas if there was something more decentralized or there were more companies, and I don't know, but it seems.
Yeah,
to
no,
me
this
that
is.
That
a, I think this topic definitely came up when in the Amazon AWS outage in December. I mean, when Facebook went down, it was basically everything owned by Facebook was down. You understood that the rest of the world was essentially, unless you were using Facebook to log into something else, which some people were doing with the credentials, the rest of the world carried on. With the AWS outage, we learned how much everybody is using US East 1. Just the one region, the one cloud provider is powering so much. And so I got invited onto the Fox Business with Neil Cavuto on live TV, and there was like, why is this happening? And I was like, well, you know, let's just take a step back. I mean, one thing is this is a service that is wildly popular. Cloud services are solving problems. And this outage is kind of the flip side of that success. And it's hard to know. This is kind of a knowable question, but let's say there was 1,000 companies that got knocked out for that period of time. How long had they been on AWS? Maybe a year. How many little outages would those companies have had that they didn't have because of they had kind of put this on AWS and they take the responsibility for running this? So there is a trade-off. Like you're not having outages normally that you're responsible for. You kind of outsource that. AWS is keeping this online until they don't, but that's quite rare. In the meantime, everybody's up all the time. And I mean, that didn't put a dent, in my opinion, at all in the cloud business. It still is a good. You still have this issue of consolidation. You have a handful of companies that can take down a lot of connectivity. And
the provider side then? We're talking about CDNs and other types of, you know, Facebook and Google, however you want to define them. But what about actual providers?
Oh, like network service providers?
Yeah.
So there's two dynamics there. There's one at a national level that ends up being governed by the how much the regulator of that country tries to introduce and foster competition. And that's the lack of competition is a measure of the regulator's power to control the market. And there's lots of countries that have dominant incumbents. Like every country started the same way. Everybody started with a state telecom. The government started this thing, whether that's 100 years ago with telegraph wires or something, but everybody started with a state telecom. And then that is now, that whatever version of that exists today is now the incumbent. Sometimes that still is the state government-owned thing. Sometimes it's been privatized. But then there's a regulator that's trying to foster competition. And I think at least in the business of telecommunications, it's an accepted truth that more competition breeds lower prices, better service. But it also, depending on how strong that incumbent is, they may cost them jobs. They've got a lot of pull and sway, and so they'll fight some of those. So at the national level, you have this. So Canada is an example of one that's not. It's not the worst, but it's not. They could have more competition. I mean, the United States could as well. I mean, you could take any. There's lots of countries that you could make this argument about. And then at a much higher level, you've got like the backbone providers, the big global networks, and. I guess we've seen some consolidation in there. At that level, it's kind of. It's interesting to me you have to move a lot of traffic to make any money, and you have to be really big, and it's a commodity thing. And anytime your product turns into a commodity, then it's just can you move large amounts, and it becomes cutthroat on price and scale, and so you have these very large companies trying to move huge amounts traffic with very few people, as few engineers as you can, just as much equipment as you need. There's been some consolidation. You've got they're Lumen now, who owned Level 3, who bought Global Crossing and XO, and all those companies are now CenturyLink is all one thing. So there's been some consolidation there. And then there's others that are essentially national champions that are probably not going to be they're too important to be acquired. NTT, Japan's not going to be acquired. Even Tata, based in India, is not going to be. Maybe they will. I don't know. I guess I can't
right,
say.
Right. No, but, well, you know, it's interesting that you started to bring up this this distinction between privatized carriers, carriers that were started as state-run businesses, things like that, because it started to get me thinking of the last section or maybe the middle section of your blog post. You talked about outages in Cuba, the protests in Iran, and then the resultant behavior from the national government there to shut things down. That's something that we're starting to see. Ukraine as well, right? There is this – you were going to say something. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say the lots of outages in Ukraine, not so much government-directed. I mean, they're getting bombed. It's happening, you know, still to this day.
Nevertheless, a result of sort of geopolitical occurrences.
For sure, for sure.
In this case, war, which is not the same as the government trying to shut down a protest or stop the flow
right.
of information. So that is true. But nevertheless, it's nation states making decisions to control information, and that's really where I was getting at with Cuba and Iran. That is a very different type of outage, isn't it, and disruption on the internet. We've talked about natural disasters and undersea cables and satellite and human error, which is probably the most ubiquitous type of outage, right? But now we're seeing this happen more and more, and you're reporting on it. I see your Twitter feed. I see your LinkedIn posts all the time about nations that say, no, we're going to shut you down, citizenry. How is that playing into this? Is this becoming a more widespread thing that's happening among countries?
Yeah, I mean, on this topic, I got into it long ago with the Arab Spring, back when I was with Renesas. We were already mapping out the global internet with a live picture of the internet in any country. And so when Egypt went offline, we could pull that up immediately and understand what was up, what was down, with the timing. And then we worked with the global media outlets to tell that story from a technical standpoint. And I've never stopped kind of covering this from trying to come up with ways to contribute some technical analysis to our understanding of these things. But they don't seem to stop. It's very hard to order a sovereign nation to do to stop doing something bad, and whether that's shutting off internet or other things. But this one, I thought this fall we saw a couple more instances of what's been termed as a internet curfew, where internet service gets turned down for a period of time deliberately and then restored later. And it's often in the evening. It's often focusing more on mobile services, mm-hmm. And leaving fixed line up. And what the issue is that, this in each case, going back to, we saw this first in Gabon, and then Myanmar last year did this after the military coup. In each case, the rationale is there's definitely some cost to shutting all your services off. There's cost to the businesses of your country. There's lots of things. It's disruptive to the government itself. And so to hedge that, then they want to try to isolate, be a little more surgical about shutting things off. And there's blocking, censoring particular types of web services is one thing that's done quite a bit. And then another thing is to, in the case of like Iran is a good example. This went for more than a couple of weeks, where basically the three major mobile providers basically turn off their service, but starting in the early evening and going into the early morning. And what they're trying to do is try to disrupt the protesters in the street, their ability to communicate to each other and organize, their ability to report in a live. I mean, eventually, service is going to come back and they can report at that point. But at the moment, they're unable to, tell each other what's going on. And then at the same time, anybody who's using fixed line, those are people in offices. These are people in those people. Their service, for the most part, remains online. There's things that are getting for services that aren't blocked. And so that's their way to try to lower the cost of a government-directed shutdown. And we may see more of this. We it was both Cuba and Iran happening almost simultaneously this fall. Last year was Myanmar. There aren't that many examples of it, but I think these guys look at other countries and see what they do, and others may learn from that and be like, well, that's a good way to keep not upset the business community and the government get those pesky protesters to not be able to communicate.
These pesky protesters. I mean, you say there aren't that many examples, right? But they are a very top of mind. I mean, this notion of authoritarian governments shutting down protests in and of itself by shutting off the flow of information, though it's very few as far as the examples that we can point to, they're very profound, I think, in their impact and in the discussion, the philosophical discussion on the future of the internet, its use by humanity just to propagate information and to be connected. Now, separate note, but just thinking now about the global internet, right? How BGP operates and how it's so much of a trust relationship. You know, I can take in a full feed. I can advertise pretty much whatever I want, right? Beyond a password for an adjacency and some other things like that. Do you see that as a problem? Is now that this is not 1994, where the internet was this cool idea that's never going to take off, and now is the lifeblood of our society, at least in the United States and in many other nations, is the security component of the internet, maybe specifically BGP, but of the internet, an issue? Because we are seeing, you know, hospitals, hospital systems with 80,000, 100,000 employees, like in the New York tri-state area, get, hijacked and shut down until they pay a ransom. And expand that to a global scale, shutting down a country unless you do what I say, you know, that sort of thing.
Let's see, I guess on the routing, topic of routing security, I think for those of us that work in that space and think about it a lot, I think the number one message to communicate to people who aren't in that space is that this is a very hard problem, and it is a constellation of problems. It is not one thing. There's a whole bunch of sub issues here. We're not going to deploy a single technology in a day that solves this. It's just you can only imagine trying. You've got a routers all across the world, an internet of routers that all have to. We've got to get them to do something different. That is really hard to do. So the problem's very hard, but I would also, and it's not solved, but I guess I'm a glass half full kind of guy, and here's why. So there's it's RPKI ROV, route origin validation, is the technology that's getting pushed these days on trying to limit certain types of these problems. You can imagine there's a spectrum of these issues, and on one end is the bonehead errors, just stupid stuff. And when I started doing this a little over 10 years ago, there was lots of stuff happening on that end of the spectrum, and probably lots of stuff happening on the other end too. But we had made no progress on even easy or like just dumb errors. And I feel like these days, with the adoption of RPK ROV, so what this is basically folks who own internet resources, so IP addresses specifically we're talking about, can go into their RIR portal. If you're in North America, you go into ARIN, you set up, like, what is the proper origin that you would want, who should be originating this in BGP land, and that gets communicated to everybody in the system. If they see something at somebody else, then they'll drop. If they see another origin, they'll drop that route if they're also participating in the system. It's not foolproof, but it does reduce the impacts of origination leaks when somebody accidentally barfs out a bunch of a full table. I mean, we haven't had one of those in a long time. And and I think it's not just RPKI. There's things like, I don't want to get into all these, but things like peer lock is something that this is where the major providers look at. They just filter. They should not be receiving other, like a people in the, we call them the TFC or DFC, default free zone, like the top of the internet, top of the internet hierarchy. So it's a fully connected mesh. This is the way the internet has to operate. Any link gets disconnected, then there's a partition, and one part can't touch another. But at the top, it's a full partition. But they should, so let's say take like Lumen and let's say NTT. Lumen should not be receiving NTT stuff from one of its customers. Is essentially the gist of it. And you can come up with a handful of rules that just what are the what would be the AS paths that should be automatically rejected. That's widely deployed, and so I would say that a lot of these major bonehead things are they don't happen that much anymore. And I would add also that you know I was one of the people who was writing up a lot of sketchy internet routing issues involving China Telecom, and this got a lot of circulation in national security circles. It's led to the FCC to revoke China Telecom's license to operate telecommunication services in the United States. We used to see them involved in these leaks. I can't tell you the last one that China Telecom was a part of it. And yeah. You know, they had joined Manners, which is the Internet Society's effort mm-hmm. to try to. And there's not really any, mechanism. You join and you pledge to do a bunch of things, and then they mm-hmm. are kind of vouching that you're actually doing these. And there's some attempt to try to check up on this. It's not. It's mostly a pledge, and then you'd be shamed if you did something wrong.
Ultimately, it's a trust relationship.
They joined it, and I haven't seen them in one of these in a while, and so maybe we are making some progress.
I have to imagine that it behooves any country that has any kind of nefarious intention to not do that when they are interacting with other nations as a means of doing business, of interacting with other countries to keep peace. So as much as you might have this nefarious intention, I know this is going to be a strange analogy, Doug, but I just watched The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly with Clint Eastwood, one of my favorite movies, right? I love Westerns. And my wife was with me, and she's like, did they really act like that? And I'm like, not really. You know, I did some quick Googling on my phone while we were watching the movie, and I was just reading that a lot of this stuff is fantasy and hyperbole for movie
effects. It's a good story, though.
Yeah, it's a great story. I love it. I love the spaghetti westerns very, very much. And the fact is that folks went out to the West, U.S., cowboys and families and ranchers and all these people alike to make a better life for themselves. You had the bad element, but it wasn't this Wild West that we see in Clint Eastwood movies and other movies like that, John Wayne movies. It was much, much more calm, with, of course, those exceptions. And I have to imagine that that's true on a nation-state level, on a provider level, on a on the global scale with regard to the internet. We're all trying to do the best we can for ourselves. It's self-interest, and I get that, and that's okay. But it's in my self-interest as a country to make sure I'm not screwing up my relationship with other countries, because that's a great source of income keeping peace.
It's a good point. It is a property of the internet, but I would also add I'll shift gears from being a Pollyanna to there's a lot of assumptions on the internet. Like, for example, when we've exhausted V6. All the V6 that's gonna IP address that's gonna be used. It's already been given out. There's no more.
The V4?
Sorry, V4. Yeah, right. You're not running out of V6 yet. Sorry, V4.
We have a few more V6.
Yeah, excuse me, I misspoke. But if we got to a point where, let's say, China is like, you know what, we think, let's say. Not that long ago, before they DoD started announcing all this address space, it was a big story last year. They were sitting on a ton that nobody was using, like 4 billion addresses or something, or maybe not 4 billion. Yeah, there was some large amount, a few hundred million. And Chinese companies would use these internally, use US DoD address space internally, and nothing's to stop them as long as it's not out on the internet and occasionally
they're
it would
just
leak
numbers,
out or something.
Routers
if you ran a trace route, it'd be kind of funny because you'd be like China, 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 DoD, China, China, China.
Yeah.
But you could get to a point where countries no longer agree on what are the norms of respecting these boundaries, because there's no way to enforce any of this. And right now, it's still we're all in this weary of this common good. Even though some countries may be at war with each other, they still respect these boundaries. But I don't know. I think it's one of these things where that's a line that could get crossed at some point. So for like, let's say Ukraine has, their vice president had called for this IT army to attack things in Russia. If you wanted to support Ukraine, you'd attack, and people were, participating in this. This still happens. I mean, if they really wanted to, they could start just announcing all their Russian address space and just screwing, and Russia could start announcing all of the Ukrainian address space, and it would just be a complete mess. That's a line. I think we just assume that would never get crossed, but it could.
Hypothetical, isn't it?
There is a possibility of the stuff breaking apart.
There's no technical reason that
there's no technical reason. Those things could
happen or could.
So, I'll just say one more thing, Phil. So we talked about the reasons to be optimistic on routing security, but then the flip side of that is that there's a lot of things that aren't solved, and there's been a few cryptocurrency attacks that were very profitable for the folks that pulled these off, and these are the sophisticated attacks. So I mentioned the spectrum of one end's bonehead, the other end's sophisticated. We call it a determined adversary. Is the phraseology?
What was that term again?
A determined adversary. If you are really determined to defeat RPKROV, you can do it. Mm-hmm. And there's ways to manipulate the system that just aren't, we just haven't solved yet. And there are people who are doing this now. And I think as we clean up the bonehead section, and experts can kind of keep moving the needle up towards the determined adversary, then I think we can start to tighten down and make that costlier if we can't make it completely prevented, and maybe some of these scenarios can be prevented. But there's a lot happening in that space as well, in the determined adversary, BGP hijacks.
Yeah, and with regard to this entire idea of outages that we've been talking about and major disruptions on a large scale, global scale, certainly more complex than the few things that we've mentioned today. Right, the theme that I picked out. Natural disasters and human error and nation states being authoritarian in their control of information. It's actually much more than that. And we touched on BGP security as well. So in any case, Doug, we're at time. Great conversation. So much we can unpack. I think we can turn this into about 20 different podcasts, maybe a series on internet analysis. In fact,
I love talking about this stuff. So
I appreciate
that. Happy to do it.
So as we wrap up here, I'd like to give you an opportunity. How can folks reach out to you if they don't know already? How they can reach out to you to ask a question, make a comment?
I am still on Twitter. I haven't departed. I still think it's probably going to be around for a while. That's probably the easiest. I'd put some things there. I'm on LinkedIn as well. You can feel free to send me an invite. If you're in the business, I usually accept it, and then I try to start a conversation about, like, what is it you're interested in, and see if there's any commonality with our interests.
Right. What's your Twitter handle?
It's just at Doug Madori, DougMadory.
Great. And I believe you blog pretty frequently on the Kentik
blog. I try to, blog.
Right. Okay. So make sure to check that out. You can find me on Twitter, @network_Phil. I am still very active there. I'm also on LinkedIn. You can search me there. My blog is networkphil.com. Not as frequently posting recently, but you can still check it out. So until next time, thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.